Hello there. Today is Monday, October 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump makes a big announcement over the weekend regarding the leader of ISIS.
Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
A weekend vigil for a young girl held in Nigeria by Boko Haram for not denouncing her Christian faith. Also ahead, a final farewell to the longest-serving African-American U.S. congressman. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump announced over the weekend that U.S. Special Forces, with the assistance of the Kurds, took down Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports.
Speaking in the White House diplomatic room for nearly 50 minutes, Trump announced the Islamic State leader detonated a suicide vest in a tunnel, also killing three children, when he was confronted by the U.S. force, which lost no personnel. The president says Baghdadi was screaming, crying, and whimpering in his last moments.
He didn't die a hero, he died a coward.
Baghdadi's remains were positively identified by DNA testing on site in 15 minutes, according to Trump. The president says the leader's possible replacements as head of the terrorist organization are already in the sights of American forces. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
And joining us now for more details is VOA national security correspondent Jeff Seldon. Jeff, just how big of a deal was this?
This is a huge deal. It's tremendously symbolic because Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was the face of the Islamic State Caliphate. He is the terrorist leader who took a group that was formed from the remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which became the Islamic State of Iraq, and turned it into an organization that for a while held a slice of territory that encompassed much of Syria and Iraq, and ran it under the Islamic State's version of Islamic Sharia law. And under him, ISIS grew to a global terror threat to the point where it prompted a global coalition led by the United States to not only begin to bomb and conduct airstrikes against this group, but to partner with forces on the ground to fight for years to finally roll it back to the point where this past March, the territory that it controlled finally was liberated and that the group had to revert to an insurgency. So this is big. This is big. The question is going to be whether or not the Islamic State can recover from this. And they suffered another blow a day after the raid that took out al-Bakr al-Baghdadi in northwestern Syria in an area called Bashira, which is in Idlib province. Another raid was conducted in the town of Jarablus, which is right near the Turkish border. And according to the Syrian Democratic Forces, which they partnered with the U.S., they struck empty oil tanker. The ISIS spokesman, Abu Hassan al-Muhajir, was using to travel around in the area. So in a matter of 2 days, two of the most senior, most influential Islamic State leaders have been killed. It's a big blow to the group, but the group's been here before. They found ways to recover, and U.S. intelligence officials and Western intelligence officials are wary that the fight is not yet over.
It's interesting. A New York Times article just posted that says that this happened in spite of Trump's actions in Syria, not because of them, that troop withdrawal made it more difficult for this operation. Do you know anything about that?
Well, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which have been praised by U.S. military leaders for the last couple of years as being the most reliable ground forces, the forces that really enabled the air campaign to have an impact because they were able to go in and clean up on the ground and take on and fight mano a mano against the Islamic State fighters. They've been saying for the last couple of days that the U.S. actions in terms of pulling out their troops, and it was a small number of troops from northeastern Syria, and letting the Turks go in. Again, U.S. in a tough position here because Turkey is an ally, a NATO ally, but the U.S. has partnered with the SDF, mainly Kurdish, with many of its fighters coming from a group called the YPG, which has links to a terror group in Turkey that is recognized as a terror group by the United States. So this pullout diverted their attention. There was a lot of thought that there was going to be possibly massive prison breaks by the about 12,000 Islamic State fighters that were being held in SDF-run prisons. There was concern that the Islamic State, which has done this in the past and done this very well in other areas, would take advantage of the chaos to launch a new round of attacks. So there's been concern that this was going to have a detrimental effect, the troop pullout, the withdrawal by the U.S. on the fight against Islamic State. Despite that, though, the SDF said they continued to work with the United States, even as they were saying the U.S. stabbed them in the back by exposing them to Turkey and the Turkish incursion into northeastern Syria. They continued to work with the U.S. They provided some vital information, and that enabled the U.S. to launch this raid that ultimately killed Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
All right. That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon. Thank you for being with us. Vigils were held all over the world over the weekend for a kidnapped girl being held by Boko Haram in Nigeria. Nigeria is home to 86 million Christians. In August of 2018, Leah Sharibu was one of 110 girls kidnapped from her school. She has so far refused to denounce her Christianity. The Nigerian federal government has assured Leah's mother that it is negotiating her release. Joining us now to discuss is Didi Logason, executive director of Save the Persecuted Christians, a group heavily involved in speaking out against religious persecution and who helped organize the weekend vigil for the girl's release. Thank you for being with us. Tell us exactly what has happened with this particular young lady.
So Leah Sharibu was kidnapped in February of 2018 when she was only 14 years old. She was one of 110 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram from a Dapchi boarding school for girls. Leah was taken off with Boko Haram, and five of the girls died within a month. 104 of the girls were returned a month later after negotiations by the Nigerian federal government. But Boko Haram kept Leah Sharibu alone, and the girls who were returned said that they kept her because she stoutly refused to renounce her faith in Jesus. So they would ask, "Who here is Christian?" and her arm would shoot up. And these girls would try to pull it down. She absolutely refused to renounce her faith in Jesus. So Leah now still is with Boko Haram. They have threatened her life. And then this time last year, they'd sent out news that they were going to keep Leah as a slave for life. Mm-hmm. We have continued to advocate and lift Leah's story along with her mother, Rebecca Sharibu, and the foundation that she formed, the Leah Foundation, which advocate for both Leah and all school children who have been kidnapped in Nigeria. There are literally over 1,000 school children now held by Boko Haram.
And is the government still actually doing anything to try to get these girls back, including Leah?
When Rebecca was here in June, we brought her to Vice President Pence's office. And within a week of that visit, Vice President Pence had summoned the Nigerian vice president over to the United States to answer to these issues. And he said that they would be advocating for her release. At the end of July, a report came out from another captive who said that Leah had been killed. And we advocated a measured response. And in August this year, the Nigerian federal government said that Leah is still alive and that they are working towards her release. This week, while the Leah Foundation was in Washington, D.C., they met with Senator Ted Cruz and Tony Perkins, who is the commissioner of USERF, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And they together put out a letter to the Nigerian federal government, again, encouraging them to continue their efforts to release Leah. So we hope that they will be able to get her release soon, and that she will be welcomed home to her mother's arms.
Are you pretty confident that she is, in fact, still alive?
Yes, we believe that she is too high an asset for them to have killed her, and that they do keep her.
You mentioned five girls died in the first few months. Died or were killed?
We do not know why, but we do know that what they've been put through and the abuse that they suffered in that month was likely just horrendous. And they may have been killed while trying to escape. They may have been killed while they were being abused, but it really is a mystery.
Have you had any word on Leah's conditions?
No, we have no word since she was seen in a video a year ago at the end of August, sitting on a mat, dressed in a hijab and a full robe, and pleading for her life.
If Leia were able to get communication from you, what would you say to her? Would you tell her to just stay strong and continue her faith, or would you tell her to, you know, say whatever she needs to say to be released, or would it even matter for them?
I think Leia is willingly being a witness to Jesus, to her persecutor, and I think that where she's at, God will use her to change hearts and minds and impact those who are working under deception to cause the abuse of these children.
How hopeful are you that somehow that this 15-year-old girl will be able to be reunited with her family at some point?
Yeah. Leia turned 16 in May. She spent two birthdays there. And her family, Rebecca and Nathan and her brother Donald, are eager for her to come home. We hope and pray every day that she will, in fact, be returned. But Boko Haram is one of the most dangerous terrorist organizations in the world, and we do not know if she will come home, but we do know that she stands firm in faith and is a real hero to the faith for people all over the world.
That's Dee Dee Laugesen, Executive Director of Save the Persecuted Christians. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Massive wildfires have forced a state of emergency in California. Hong Kong business people have set their sights on America. Villagers say a U.S. drone strike in Somalia has killed frankincense collectors. And a climb ban comes into force at Australia's most famous desert rock. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In Hong Kong, there were again clashes as thousands of people took to the streets for another weekend of protests. This week, the city's governing body formally withdrew the bill that sparked the original protests earlier this year, but that has done little to appease protesters in this leaderless movement who say they want the government to do more to stave off what they believe is encroaching control from Beijing. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Hong Kong.
Buoyed from afar, thousands took to Hong Kong streets this weekend in force for the 21st week of anti-government protests. But they were met with fierce resistance from the city's embattled police force. Last week, Vice President Mike Pence became the highest-ranking member of the Trump administration to voice strong support for the anti-Beijing movement, now entering its fifth month in this semi-autonomous Chinese city.
To the millions in Hong Kong who have been peacefully demonstrating to protect your rights these past months, we stand with you. We are inspired by you, and we urge you to stay on the path of nonviolent protest.
That message of nonviolence didn't carry, with clashes and vandalism that only intensified as night fell. In previous months, other protests have turned chaotic and violent, with police firing tear gas, water cannon, rubber bullets, and the occasional live round. Opposition legislator Ted Hui told VOA the violence disrupts what he says should be peaceful protests.
It's not something that Hong Kong people would like to see. It's not something the world would like to see. But I still urge the people to look through the surface and understand the background why people are so angry. And there's no other ways of expressing their grief. And that's why they are resorting to some other means. Might not be right, but the government should have responded to the five demands, and the problem will be totally solved.
In fact, Hong Kong legislators this week formally withdrew the bill that lit the spark of these leaderless protests earlier this year, a controversial extradition bill that would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be tried in mainland China. Opponents felt it symbolized Beijing's increasing control over Hong Kong. Protesters' demands have grown to include demands for universal suffrage and an investigation into the police.
But now the focus has shifted from the extradition bill to the police force itself, when they've beaten up so many young people and the public even suspected they killed some young people.
Some protesters say they're determined to keep the peace, which could signal a growing rift between pacifists, who say they just want peaceful demonstrations, and those who have resorted to vandalism and have been met with police action.
I disagree with violence. So if there's violence, I will walk away.
That was tested on this night, as fire, water, and tear gas, once again, washed over Hong Kong's once peaceful streets. Anita Powell, VOA News, Hong Kong.
Success on the international trade front is a top issue for U.S. farmers, as VOA's Keen Farabaugh reports. This segment of the American landscape, which largely voted for President Donald Trump in 2016, faces difficult economic conditions ahead of next year's presidential contest because of higher costs to operate farms, falling profits, and an uncertain trade environment.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPP, the United States signed with 11 other countries in 2016, would have given U.S. farmers more places to market their crops. Despite then-candidate Donald Trump's promise to withdraw from the TPP, largely on concerns over the impact to U.S. manufacturing jobs, Illinois farmer Wendell Shaman supported him, despite wanting the TPP agreement.
You're a farmer, you have a PhD, you're well-traveled, you understand how trade agreements and international trade works, and you voted for Trump.
Yes.
Since 2016, not only did the U.S. withdraw from the TPP, it dismantled the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement. A replacement, the United States-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, or USMCA, is under review in the U.S. Congress. Meanwhile, the Trump administration simultaneously is waging a trade war with one of its biggest crop buyers, China, which imposed tariffs on U.S. corn and soybeans in retaliation for U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. This has affected profits for Shaman, but not his support for Trump's re-election.
What I hear on the other side, how happy they support what he's doing versus what they're proposing.
Shaman, who worries a Democratic president may impose environmental regulations affecting his farm operations, is not alone.
I was excited to see a Republican take back the White House, but I love the stance that we're taking.
I think he's doing what is right.
I think the majority of our people by far are still supportive of the president.
Illinois Farm Bureau's Mark Gebhardt says Trump has been able to blunt the impact of tariffs through payments to farmers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Market Facilitation Program. This year it cost taxpayers about $16 billion, on top of roughly $15 billion in 2018.
We want trade, not aid. We don't want to have to live hoping that we get another round of market facilitation payments. We really need, again, to find just a final way forward on not only the tariffs with China, but USMCA, Japan, EU, all these other issues that are out there.
Yet the lack of substantial trade progress during his first term causes concern among some Trump voters.
I really feel like he doesn't understand what happens out here in these flyover states. He's walking a very thin line with what's been happening in the ag sector.
Megan Dwyer says the Trump administration's waivers for oil refineries to use corn-based ethanol, the president's tweeting, and his mixed results on trade could affect her vote.
Some of his comments recently around ag are frustrating to me.
Amid an ongoing impeachment inquiry in the U.S. Congress, a straw poll conducted by Farm Journal Pulse in September showed 76% of 1,138 farmers polled support Trump in 2020, down from 79% in July.
I think there's a lot of people that are disappointed, but it's going to come down to the choice they give us. And right now, for most farmers, I don't think he's going to lose many.
Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Kirkwood, Illinois.
Former U.S. Representative John Conyers, one of the longest-serving members of Congress whose resolutely liberal stance on civil rights made him a political institution in Washington and back home in Detroit, despite several scandals, has died. This report comes to us from WXYZ in Conyers' hometown of Detroit.
I'm deeply honored to have come to the Congress in 1965.
And it was an honor that would make him the longest serving African-American congressman in history.
I love my job. It's very simple. Are you ready for a victory?
He celebrated many victories in his lifetime, John James Conyers Jr., was born in Highland Park, May 16, 1929. He graduated from Detroit's Northwestern High School, served in the Korean War, and went on to law school. He initially turned down a job in the office of the late legendary Congressman John Dingell, but then realized his mistake and pleaded for a second chance.
He listened to me go through all this, and he put his arm around me and said, "Let's go down to Saunders and have a milkshake." And that started me off.
Conyers became active in the civil rights movement before making his own first bid for Congress and picked up some powerful support.
I was endorsed by Martin Luther King Jr. at Central United Methodist Church.
He held positions of leadership on powerful committees and was the only member of the Judiciary Committee to take part in the impeachment hearings of both Presidents Nixon and Clinton.
After yesterday's considerable misstatements by members of the majority, I rise to set the record straight.
John Conyers was 90. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Our voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. People in Laos had always converted materials into everyday items from hundreds of millions of bombs dropped there during the Vietnam War. And that idea has inspired a New York woman to make jewelry from the fragments of bombs and use some of the profits to help Laos clear millions of explosives that never went off. Valdia Baraputri reports.
It's so cold.
These pieces of jewelry were made from explosives, the remnants of the secret war in Laos more than 40 years ago. During the Vietnam War, the United States bombarded central Laos with bombs to disrupt supply routes used by North Vietnamese troops. More than 10 years ago, Elizabeth Suda visited Laos and saw residents melting explosives such as bombs and mines and transforming them into spoons. She was inspired and subsequently founded a company called Article 22.
I went to Laos after having a short career in the fashion industry here in New York, and I became very interested in how fashion could be more sustainable. I saw how much money people spent to look good, but I thought, well, what if that fashion did good too?
Article 22 works with dozens of silver and metal artisans in Laos to craft various types of jewelry, such as bracelets, necklaces, rings, and earrings. They also work with the Mines Advisory Group, an organization that cleans unexploded ordnance all over the world, including Laos, that could harm local residents. Of the hundreds of millions of bombs dropped on Laos, there are about 80 million that never exploded, spread over an area of land as large as Houston, Texas.
The more bracelets that are sold, the more we raise awareness and funds from Mines Advisory Group to clear more of those 80 million unexploded bombs.
Article 22 routinely participates in exhibitions such as this one that combines art and social activism, and in pop-up markets that sell products with social and environmental innovations. This way, they're able to explain the history behind the jewelry that they offer.
You know, so little people actually knew where about, the secret war, and there was a lot that we had to do in terms of, like, bringing awareness towards the history as a start, beyond the simple fact that we were, you know, selling jewelry that was made from bombs, so that we had, like, challenging themes to talk about.
Their tagline, "Buying Back the Bombs," illustrate their concept of clearing out bombs the U.S. had once dropped on Laos.
Yes, so take a look. It's a beautiful bracelet, right? And it has the word peace inscribed in different languages, right?
For every $155 Article 22 sells, they donate funds to clear 3 square meters of land in Laos from bombs and other explosives. From New York, Valdia Baraputri and Oliver Pross, VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers at Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania, suggests young children with atypical eating behaviors may be a sign of autism. A few examples of what the researchers considered atypical eating behaviors include those such as a narrow preference for only certain foods, being sensitive to certain food textures or temperatures, and pocketing or stuffing the mouth with food without swallowing. The study authors found that 70% of children with autism who were studied displayed these atypical eating behaviors compared to about 5% of children who did not display signs of autism. Study author Susan Mays, a professor of psychiatry, says these behaviors are present in many one-year-olds with autism, and awareness of them could provide parents and doctors with a signal that a child may have autism. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Paul Bure, guitarist and singer for the rock band Little Feat, has died. Bure's passing was announced Saturday by surviving members of the band who honored his contributions to the music world. Bure died Saturday morning at a hospital in Los Angeles at the age of 71 due to side effects from ongoing treatment for liver disease. Bure was a foundational part of Little Feat's funky blues-infected southern rock. He wrote and co-wrote some of the band's most beloved songs. Little Feat is currently on a 50th anniversary tour that Bure set out due to his health. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Peter Hundley. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.